Powell reel number two. When you went on to Netherhaven early in 1915, how did the kind of training you got there differ from the sort of training you had had at Farnborough?
Well, in a way, it didn't differ, except that I was flying a Henry Farman instead of the old Morris Farmans. And I had my first accident there. I was coming into land, flying solo in the Henry, and the aerodrome sloping down towards a track which ran across the aerodrome. It was downhill. I landed and trickled on and trickled on, and you must remember that in those days there were no such things as brakes. One had to judge the distance and just land until the thing stopped. And unfortunately, as I was going downhill, it didn't stop. It trickled on and trickled on until I hit this little path. The undercarriage collapsed and down I went. I was blamed very badly by my CO, a man called Dawes, Major Dawes, George Dawes. And I felt rather guiltless, but still, it was a bad show to have crashed an aircraft. And then afterwards, I went up and went for my exams to do for wings. I passed my engine exam, my flying I'd already passed because of the ticket, and for rigging, I passed my rigging eventually in a very queer sort of way. I was taken, it was an oral examination, and I was taken by a pilot, a captain, and I knew that in the hangar were two aircraft. One was the Morris Farman Longhorn, and the other was a Henry Farman. I was supposed to know the rigging of all those machines. The sort of question you'd be asked was, what is the length of that particular flying wire? And things like that. Well, I couldn't possibly learn all the rigging of two machines, so I decided to learn, really parrot fashion, the Henry Farman. And when I walked into the hangar, I pushed my instructor, the examiner, as far as I could, obviously towards the Longhorn on the right-hand side. And he, as I hoped, suddenly stopped, realizing I was going straight for one aircraft, stopped, turned round and said, "All right, well, we'll test you on the Henry Farman," which I knew, so I passed that. And I would have got my wings, but the only thing that stopped it was failing in one exam, which at the time struck me as rather ridiculous for a young pilot. I failed because I failed on formation of troops. What that had to do with flying as a pilot, I didn't really appreciate, but that was why I failed, and I had to go back the next week before I really qualified for my wings.
Before you went out to France, did you have any experience with any other aircraft?
Oh, yes, I learnt to fly the Vickers fighter. That was the thing with skids out in front and the monosopop engine. The engine is an extraordinary thing for a pilot to have to fly in that it had no throttle at all. It only had one speed that was flat out. And one used a thumb switch and gave a series of buzzes to taxi and then open the let the thing run flat out. But unfortunately, as you changed and got a freeway for the run, the mixture for the carburation was gradually changing too, and one flew with a hand on the thumb screw fine adjustment, which was situated on the left hand side on the floor of the machine. So you had to keep a hand on the fine adjustment, because as you took off and gathered speed, so your mixture was too rich and the engine would start missing. So you cut it down until you get the level, and after you climb to about 1,000 feet, again the air becomes a bit too rare. And so you cut down again, cut and cut and cut, and always listening to the engine. And as soon as the engine missed, you knew it was missing because it was too rich a mixture or too weak a mixture. But as you flew up and got higher and higher, you cut down and cut down and cut down. That had the disadvantage of when you came in to land from some terrific height like 4,000 feet, the mixture would change, so that you had to put the engine on when you got to about a few hundred feet, and then gradually then one had to adjust the mixture again. And many a crash was caused because the engine missed and the adjustment was not correct. Another thing about the Monosapar was it certainly paid a pilot to listen, because he flew entirely from the ear. And after I had flown with these engines something over 12 months, I could tell that his hand on heart, I could tell you whether that thing is missing because the mixture was too rich or the mixture was too weak, or that a plug had cut out or a rocker arm had broken. I could tell all those from ear. And if a rocker arm broke, one had to get down as quickly as possible, because you only had about a minute before the cylinder on this rotary engine filled up with the oil, and naturally there comes a compression. The only hope then is the piston would break, in which case you'd have a conrod flapping round before it did. If the piston didn't break, it would come up and push the cylinder out of the crankcase. And as one flew with these things as pushers, with little tail booms behind, a thing like a large shell flying off at 1,100 revs might cut the tail boom. Away goes your tail. There were no parachutes in those days. And you break your neck merely because you didn't listen to your engine. So it was a thing to fly.
Is this listening to engines a feature of most of the aircraft you experienced flying during the First World War, or is it peculiar to the Vickers and the Monosapar?
More peculiar to the Monosapar than any other engine. One other thing about the Vickers was it was flown by the pilot, and the observer in the nose of the aircraft had the machine gun, just one gun. And later, thanks to Robert Lorraine, who said that he was bored stiff flying there while his observer was able to fire at the German, and he had nothing to do, so he said, well, I'm going to have another gun. And he brought one in and fixed it on the nacelle between himself and the observer, so that now he had two guns to fire, which was quite an advance. That was the famous Robert Lorraine, the actor airman.
What was your opinion of the Vickers?
Well, I liked flying them because they hadn't got a mind of their own. A Vickers had, if anything, no dihedral, in fact, an anhedral. And the result of this was that when one came into a bank or a turn or dropped a wing, the wing would stay down until you lifted the thing up. And when one got to the things like BE-2Cs, which had quite an appreciable dihedral, that is a balanced aeroplane, that used to put on its own bank the moment you put the rudder on, which for a Vickers pilot to fly a dihedral aircraft was a nasty thing. One was fighting the aircraft. It didn't do what you wanted it to. And that is the best feature, I thought, of the Vickers. Of course, it had several defects. A, it had no speed. B, it had no ceiling. C, it couldn't take very much weight. And the only good thing was that one had good visibility from it, whereas with a tractor, that is, the engine in front, one was always balked by half the aeroplane that got in the way. And the pusher with the engine behind was, to my mind, the best form of aircraft, in that you had visibility. And what's the good of sending a fellow up into an aircraft where he's supposed to do observation and the rest of it, And he can't, he can only do about a quarter of that because he can't see out. There are bits of aeroplane in the way. His wings are always in the way. And that's why I always thought that a pusher was the finest form of aircraft, and I couldn't understand why they were dropped, except that for the manufacturers and designers, it was much easier to make a really fine aircraft as a tractor, because you've got better speed, better performance, and it's very difficult to streamline a pusher.
When you went to France in the beginning of, in the spring of 1915, were you posted immediately to a squadron?
Well, practically immediately. I had to report to the headquarters, RFC, which was at Saint-Omer. I spent the morning there in this large chateau, and I was told I'd be posted to number 5 squadron, and a tender was being sent out for me to take me up there. That, to me, at that time was most exciting because it was the first time I actually heard the gunfire as we drove. And as we drove on and on, more east, I wondered whether we were going through the lines. But France was a bigger country than I imagined, and eventually we arrived at Erbil. And number 5 squadron consisted of 3 flights. There was A, B, C. A flight was Avro's, B flight was Vickers fighters, and C flight was Avro's. Shortly after I joined, the BE-2C took the place of the Avro, but the old Vickers remained. The duties of the squadron were artillery observation, which was the A and C flight, and offensive patrols, which was the Vickers fighter. It was called the Vickers Fighting Armoured Biplane. The armour consisted of a little square of armour plate under the pilot's seat. The observer had to look out for himself. But that was too heavy, so we discarded those and never took them up. The armament consisted of 1 Lewis gun, which was in the nose, and that was fired by the observer, as I stated before, until the rain brought a second gun in.
How would you define an offensive patrol?
An offensive patrol could only last for a maximum of 2 hours, because the petrol range was only 2.25 hours flying petrol. So one had a quarter of an hour to get out to the lines and back again, and the rest of the 2-hour patrol was supposed to be flown over the lines. One flew up and down the trenches. And during that time, of course, the German anti-aircraft guns had quite a lot of practice. That in itself was interesting, in that when flying, the Germans used to bracket an aircraft, and if one was flying at 4,000 feet and suddenly hear 3 little pops, and you looked up and about 500 feet above you, you'd see the 3 shell bursts. You looked down and below you, 500 feet, would be 3 more shell bursts. After a time, the next lot, they would be only about 100 feet above you and 100 feet below. That was the time to take evasive action. And the only action one could take, as you had no engine power, was to dive. And it's rather amusing to see when you dive down as fast as you could go, about 500 feet, to see that the 6 bursts from the battery would all converge on the spot that you had been before. In addition to the the 4 Vickers fighters, which comprised B flight, we had the very first DH-2, which, as it was powered by a monozapar, had to come to B flight. B flight being the only squadron, the only flight, in fact, in France with monozapars. So we were in the happy position, if the manufacturers at home invented any new machine with a monozapar, along it came to us. I should explain here that monozapap is that the French word for one valve, mono soupape. and he'd only had one valve.
What was the significance of the scout within the flight? What was its peculiar job?
Well, its job was really mostly attack. If a German aircraft came over, this one single-seater machine was supposed to be faster, more manoeuvrable, and altogether, it was the prize for any pilot in the squadron to call himself the Scout Squadron. I should explain at that time, in that time of the war, an aeroplane and its pilot were indivisible. They weren't swapped about. No pilot went and flew another pilot's aircraft, and they were guarded as jealously as one's girlfriend. They weren't shared at all. And you can imagine the excitement of young fellows in their teens, all wanting to be the squadron scout pilot. That happily came to me after I'd had some successes in fights with the old Vickers fighter, and I became the scout pilot of number 5.
This was literally a reward for outstanding performance, as it were.
One had to be assumed to have qualified as a super-duper pilot to become the scout pilot. Again, each aircraft had its own rigger and its own fitter. And those two worked on that aircraft and on nothing else, so that the pilot, the rigger, and the fitter were, one might say, a team. And there you worked with the same machine the whole time. Yes, the gun and I knew me. Then, saw.